I want to stress from the outset that this pandemic is far from over.
This is all about trust now and personal responsibility and just being careful and not being selfish.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it.
The idea of an irreversible move was taken off the table. You can't do that when you have no idea where the virus is going to go.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
Good afternoon, I'm Ewan Potts. More teenagers in the UK are soon to be offered a COVID vaccine. We're expecting ministers to approve advice from the Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, recommended healthy over 16s be offered a jab. They're currently only offered to over 12s with underlying health conditions or those who live with others at high risk.
Now, also in Scotland today, Nicola Sturgeon has announced that most of the COVID restrictions in Scotland will be lifted on Monday, and Boris Johnson's there today. He's beginning a two-day visit to Scotland, but he rebuffed an invitation from the First Minister to meet her and discuss the pandemic recovery. Boris Johnson suggested a joint meeting with other UK First Ministers at a later date. Well, joining us now is Wendy Chamberlain, Liberal Democrat MP for North East Fife and the party's chief whip. Wendy, thanks so much for being with us this morning. Let me ask you first, in terms of the restrictions that Nicola Sturgeon has announced, the lifting of them, of course, is it the right time to do that, do you think?
Well, I think what Scotland has always done has proceeded more cautiously than particularly the UK government in relation to England. And what we are seeing is it's summertime, the Scottish schools have been out for over a month now. We finished at the end of June. And we have seen a peak in Scotland at the beginning of July that has now is now decreasing. And so it does feel like this is part of the roadmap that the Scottish Government has laid out and that we are moving in the right direction, but more cautiously. What I would say as a Scottish MP at Westminster is the challenge for me is I'm dealing with constituent casework on a regular basis, where there is confusion between what the UK government is doing and what the Scottish government is doing. And that's particularly true in the case of international travel.
Looking broadly over the past 16 months or so, has Nicola Sturgeon done a better job than Boris Johnson in dealing with the pandemic?
Well, it's interesting. I think from a communication perspective, you cannot fault the First Minister in Scotland for the way that she has approached, obviously, the regularity of the briefings, the clarity of the briefings and the information that's been provided. But I think when you actually look at the actions that the Scottish Government have taken, in comparison to the UK Government, we've had a number of the same issues. We are moving beyond level zero here in Scotland, whatever that means. But actually, the same restrictions in the main are being removed. We've had the same issues with care homes. We've had the same issues, albeit success of the vaccination rollout. We've had some of the same issues around take-up in the younger age group. The Scottish Government persisted in sending out its blue letters to send everybody an invite to vaccination. And we saw with the younger age groups that just didn't work. And as a result, we moved more slowly towards the drop-in centres that I myself was able to take the opportunity of getting my second jag at last week. And obviously you'll hear me saying jag as opposed to jab, which is a bone of contention too.
Okay, well, jags or jabs, I suppose one of the things is to get them into younger people, because that's been a massive issue. In England, there's now a talk about having teenagers getting their jabs, possibly from fairly soon, 16, 17-year-olds. There are some calls for it, for even 12-year-olds upwards. What should be the policy in Scotland?
So I think the policy in Scotland should be, as far as possible, we should be having a four nations approach to give that consistency and clarity. I think it's really difficult to give certainty given that we're dealing with COVID, but clarity and certainty is something we should be aspiring to. So from my perspective, it's very much the JCVI has previously looked only at 18 years and above, 12-year-olds, as you've rightly said, for more vulnerable groups or those looking after more vulnerable groups. So the JCVI is revisiting it and we are looking at 16 plus, and that's absolutely something that myself and the Liberal Democrats would support, and I would encourage the JCVI to keep looking at the data and also keep looking at what other governments are doing. We see the US is jagging those 12-year-olds and upwards as well. So, you know, we are still very much at the forefront of dealing with this virus, and that's why I think what the scientific data is telling us and the scientists are telling us is what we should be continuing to pay attention to.
Big announcement in Westminster tomorrow on travel restrictions, COVID travel restrictions for foreign trips. What do you want to see from that, firstly? And do you think it makes sense for Scotland and the other parts of the UK to have their own rules on leaving the country?
The reality is in Scotland, it's pretty much the same as the other parts of the UK, and indeed, actually, sometimes following a couple of weeks behind. But there's no doubt, again, going back to my constituent casework, we have people who, for work purposes or for travel other travel purposes, fly into, for example, Newcastle Airport is always popular with Scots, but potentially different rules applying. So, again, we want to have that consistency and certainty. And from a UK government perspective, this just seems to be where the Cabinet are sort of airing their different opinions in public, which just causes confusion. So we had trailed the different amber list, the amber watch list, and then it was clear that was just going to cause more confusion. And it looks like Grant Shapps is taking the blame for that, because his Cabinet colleagues are quite happy to turn on them when that confusion arises. And what that doesn't do is it doesn't help consumers, it doesn't help the travel industry, and the Liberal Democrats have been calling for support to the travel industry, additional support as furlough, et cetera, comes to an end. And, you know, it must be incredibly frustrating for those working in that sector to be dealing with that uncertainty. Some of it's out with the government control, but there's plenty that we could be doing more to help with that.
Wendy, one of the things that you mentioned, UK government there, and of course, even the term UK government sits slightly strangely, perhaps, in terms of the amount of power now vested in Edinburgh. Now, Boris Johnson is in Scotland today, perhaps waving the flag for the fact that he is Prime Minister of the United Kingdom as a whole. But he's not a popular figure in Scotland, is he? And I mean, what could he do to change that? Is it possible?
He's not a popular figure in Scotland, but dare I say, he's not a popular figure in many parts of the UK. I was in Chesham and Amersham for the recent by-election, and he was not somebody that was popular on the doorsteps at all. I think, you know, one of the issues for me in relation to Boris Johnson is he's clearly not a supporter of devolution, and devolution is simply a fact within the UK now. And for the UK to remain together, and as a Liberal Democrat politician in Scotland, I believe that Scotland's place is best served in the UK. He needs to start respecting the different government setups, and that four nations approach that is very easy as a sort of soundbite trip off the lips. We actually need to act on that. Now, I understand that he wants potentially the government to meet together as opposed to taking up Nicola Sturgeon's invitation today, but I think what we need to see is a more regular meetings taking place, and actually what is being agreed at that meetings. I think it's right for the public to have that knowledge, because what it does mean is the SNP have been very good at taking credit for a number of the things, like the furlough scheme, like the self-employment scheme, and other monies that have come to Scotland and the other devolved nations, and taking all the credit for that. And because of the low opinion of Boris Johnson and this government, it's been very easy for them to do that. And for me, as a pro-UK politician, it's quite frustrating.
On that issue, bring us up to date with where we are with polling on independence. And also, when you think that the SNP will make their next push for a referendum, when are they likely to go for that?
So I think what I would say is we are now not far away from the 100 days that the SNP used as part of a central platform of their manifesto in terms of delivering a number of things. Our sort of approach during the election was to put recovery first. Other parties absolutely agreed with us. So we want to see that happening. So 100 days, lots of talk about what they were going to do in that time. But I think when we come to look at it, there'll be failures on delivery. Yeah. From an independence perspective, we know we saw an increase in support for independence at the earlier stages of the pandemic, but that has absolutely fallen away. And we're now looking at a majority in support of remaining in the UK. And the Scottish Government have been very quiet on independence of late. So I suspect that they are paying attention to the polls too.
But But Wendy, I mean, you mentioned the recent elections, and the truth is, with what you were putting over, the Lib Dems did not cut through in a big way. You haven't dramatically increased your representation at Holyrood. You're not a party that perhaps has the position it once had. What are you guys doing wrong?
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's no doubt that the constitutional question has been challenging for the Liberal Democrats, as well as looking at Brexit. Now, you know, a majority of people in Scotland voted to remain in the EU, and the Liberal Democrats are still absolutely in that position. I think for us, you know, a lot of the things that we stood for in relation to devolution have been achieved, and the Scottish people, Welsh people, those in Northern Ireland have seen those benefits. I think what I am very much hoping is we are now, our leader in Scotland, Willie Rennie, has just stepped down after 10 years, leading us through multiple elections and referendums. We're obviously looking to who that new leader will be later this month. And I think that's a real opportunity for a reset. I joined the party myself in 2015, so I'm very much part of that kind of new generation, and I'm very much looking forward to. I'm heading to Inverness today to provide support in a by-election to get that Liberal Democrat message out in the doors, because that local campaigning, that community politics, is something that we've had as a strength, and I hope very much we're able to build up again.
Are you going to put your name forward to for the leadership?
I can't be leader because I'm not an MSP.
So probably not.
Let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics today. Well, the majority of Whitehall civil servants won't return full-time to the office, according to The Times. Flexible working will probably become the new norm under plans that would cap some at 2 days a week in the office. Government departments are being left to decide whether or not staff should go back.
The future of NVIDIA's planned $40 billion takeover of Cambridge-based chipmaker Arm is in question. The UK is considering blocking the takeover due to national security concerns. Boris Johnson's been moving to protect critical national infrastructure, and Arm's position at the heart of the chipmaking industry also means the deal has raised red flags over competition.
And British holidaymakers going to Europe may be forced to pay in order to be allowed in. The EU is moving ahead with plans to pre-screen travellers entering the Schengen area in order to prevent the need for visas. It could cost visitors just over £6 to undergo those checks.
Well, let's speak now to Bloomberg opinion columnist Therese Raphael. Thanks so much for joining us, Therese, fresh from a trip to the US. Boris Johnson is also on a trip today. He's in Scotland. Michael Gove said recently that if there is clearly a settled will in favour of a referendum, then one will occur. Do you detect some softening in the Westminster government's position on Scottish independence?
Perhaps a little, but I think that's partly because the SNP has been very quiet on the issue of independence since the May Scottish election. And that was a big moment for the UK. The SNP interpreted it as a mandate for another referendum vote, but since then, there's, you know, no real movement on that front. So I think the government feels that it has a little bit more room to tell Scots, look, you know, if it's your will in the future, we'll grant a referendum. They know very, very well that Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has said that the priority is the coronavirus, and that there would be no talk of a referendum until the crisis has passed. She's not defined when that would be. So I think there's a bit of wiggle room on both sides. And of course, Boris Johnson knows that there are a number of issues the SNP has just not really addressed to anyone's satisfaction. For example, you know, how you prevent a hard border with England, you know, how quickly Scotland would be able to join the EU, how would it move to a Scottish currency? All those questions that come up every time there's serious discussion of a referendum. And the SNP will be discussing some of these in a conference that's coming up. But until then, I think the UK government is really all about emphasizing the importance of the union, the benefits that the union gives Scotland, and, you know, not trying to sort of rattle things by denying the idea of a vote, but sort of saying, look, if it is a settled will of the Scottish people, in the future there will be a vote. Meanwhile, you know, let's talk about all the things you get from the union. And I think that's sort of the strategy here, as well as to point out the importance of the coming COP26 conference on climate, and sort of reinforcing that as a major part of Boris Johnson's agenda.
Yeah, because that really is very front and centre, it seems at least, of his government's concerns, and putting it over a good position at least in terms of some of the eco-agenda issues. But Therese, interesting, I mean, you're just back from the US. You had a sense, I suppose, of perhaps the different ways in which the United States is dealing with this and the way the UK is dealing with it. Just take us through what you saw.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is obviously the U.S. is a very big country, and you can observe many differences between states and even within states in attitudes toward the virus. I mean, what struck me, and I was in three different cities, was, you know, just the attitudes toward masking and how, you know, we always talk about this over here, but you really see it when you're in the States, just how politicized masking and the virus is. So, you know, in some places, you know, you had people really resent those who walked around with masks, and, you know, in other places, it wasn't such a big deal. But I think what we're seeing now is that when I got there, I landed in Boston, the Delta variant was just really registering a pretty sharp increase in places like Provincetown at the end of Cape Cod, and so you began to see masks reappearing, and you know, people there saying they hadn't seen them at some time, and you know, since I got back, you know, less than 48 hours ago, you now see, say, the mayor of New York saying that vaccines will be required. Companies like Google and Apple and Netflix either putting on hold plans to reopen their offices or demanding employees be vaccinated. We heard Vanguard is paying employees to vaccinate. So, you know, all of these sort of questions around, you know, whether the attempts to induce people to vaccinate are working or whether more kind of compulsory measures are required now. Those are the sorts of debates we're seeing. And, you know, maybe it's putting the UK policy into a more favorable light. You know, 2 weeks ago we had a sort of quiet Freedom Day, you know, as Boris Johnson reopened and lifted restrictions and at the same time told people to be vigilant. And now the trend in the Delta cases, the low rates of hospitalization, it all seems to be vindicating the UK approach to sort of doing things a little bit more slowly, whereas the US parts of it seem to be more on the back foot and they're sort of scrambling to figure out ways to encourage more people to vaccinate in areas where vaccination rates are still too low.
Did you get a sense in the US that the Delta variant is changing the debate? Is it causing panic or concern there? Of course, we've had it here in the UK for some time, but it's relatively new in the US, isn't it?
Yeah, I did have a sense that people were not, you know, quite clear how to respond to it. And again, you know, areas where you have high levels of vaccination, there is less concern simply because all the evidence has shown that, you know, you're very unlikely to get a severe case of the disease if you've been double vaccinated, let alone hospitalization and risk of death. What they have noticed, for example, in San Francisco, the Delta surge appears to be largely in the 25 to 39-year-old age group. So millennials, they account now for half of all new cases, and yet this age group has a lower tendency to be vaccinated. So I think only about 66% were fully vaccinated. So a lot of the policy discussion has turned to the question of how do you encourage vaccinations among those who have resisted, and, you know, rather than, you know, reimposing restrictions for the society as a whole. You don't really hear talk about that. It's more about, you know, what do you do to get people vaccinated, and really also about company policy. How do you get people back to the office when you've got this risk of Delta? And of course, there are stories of people who are double vaccinated who get the Delta variant and, you know, don't necessarily just get a mild case, although that's, you know, that's still pretty rare.
But that, of course, backs up what seems, I think, to many people surprising how much there is here of denialism over the COVID, over the vaccine. Is that also true in the US? I mean, there has historically been quite a lot of pushback against any attempt to impose things from the centre on people. Is that growing? Is it staying the same? What's the mood amongst the anti-vaxxers?
I think it's so heavily polarized that you have, you know, people tend to fall either into the category of fully bought into the importance of the vaccine as the key way to protect them from the virus, and those who either don't want to be vaccinated, also not have not bought into the protective value of masks, and you know they're really quite militantly against it. And you know, I don't know how you bridge that divide, because it's so tied in also to political identity and to this notion of, you know, and to American notions of of liberty. And you know, people are very vocal about it, whereas here I think you have more acceptance of government guidance. In the UK particularly, you know, even though masks are not required, you still see a lot of people wearing them indoors. There's just a sense of, you want to be prudent, or at least you don't resent others who find that they feel more comfortable with masking. In the U.S., it's like everything is political, right? I think that's a really standing in the way of increasing vaccination rates and protections in those areas where you don't have such high level of penetration in vaccines. So that's, you know, why we're seeing a reaction now in New York, in San Francisco, and even some problems in Florida, which had gotten, you know, high levels of credit for lowering cases. We're now seeing cases and hospitalizations rising there.
And something that I think the US is ahead of the UK on, which is something we've explored, which is bribing people to get vaccines. I read that there are various different schemes in the US on that front.
The US is now getting very creative in, you know, encouraging people to be vaccinated by, you know, either rewarding them, with lotteries or payment, or simply, simply requiring a vaccination, as, you know, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is doing. I don't think we're quite there yet in the UK, but partly because vaccine uptake has been pretty good. What they now need to do is try to find ways to increase uptake in minority areas, and particularly among young people who just don't perceive the risk of getting ill to be that high, and you know, may not want to take a few days off work if the jab makes them feel a bit unwell. So you know, that's the challenge in the UK, and I think that's very mixed up in this question of, you know, whether people will be driven back into offices. And you just reported that in Whitehall that maybe only be 2 days a week, so people may not feel that compelled to be vaccinated if that's the case.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.